Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
Hi, my name's Eric. I'll be reading you selections from the e-edition of today's Cape Cod Times, dated today, Monday, March 25th of 2024. We'll start with the weather, as we always do. Across the Cape and Islands today, breezy with times of clouds and sun, a high of 43 expected. Tonight, cloudy with rain and drizzle later on, a low of 37 in the overnight. Tomorrow, Tuesday, breezy with on and off rain and drizzle expected throughout the day, a high of 47, a low of 43. Wednesday looks to be the same. Cloudy with showers in the afternoon, a high of 50, low of 44. Thursday, very similar, some rain, maybe a thunderstorm in the afternoon, high of 50, low of 43. And on Friday, same, rain in the morning, otherwise cloudy with periods of rain throughout the day. High of 47, low of 36. So, starting tonight and throughout the weekdays all the way through Friday, rain, 50 degrees the high, mid-40s the low. The sun will rise at 6:35 a.m. this morning. It's about an hour away. It will set at 6:59 p.m. this evening. We'll have 12 hours and 24 minutes of daylight. The moonrise will be at 7:34 p.m. It will set at 6:47 a.m. Now, heading to the front of the paper, where the news and, of course, the lottery results are kept. And we read the lottery results because somebody asked for them. If there's something you would like read to the people who are blind and print disabled, you can email us at info@audiblelocalledger.org. Or call us at 508-539-2030, and we'll consider reading it. And if you miss any of the information that we share, you can always go to audiblelocalledger.org. In the upper right corner is the archived readings tab. If you click on that, you'll find a week's worth of our newspaper readings that you can catch up on. You click on the literature readings tab, you'll find a lot of entertaining, great literature. Some of it shortened for you, and some of it full length, and it stays up there in perpetuity. And all of that is free for people who are blind or print disabled at audiblelocalledger.org in one of our tabs. Now, for the latest results of the lottery, we go to the masslottery.com website because the Cape Cod Times goes to press too early to give you the latest results. You certainly deserve those because you asked for them. The numbers game for Sunday, March 24th of 2024. In the midday yesterday, the numbers were 1, 9, 4, 6. Again, yesterday's midday drawing in the numbers game, 1, 9, 4, 6. Last night's evening drawing of the numbers game for Sunday, March 24th, 8, 3, 4, 5. The evening drawing of the numbers game last night, 8, 3, 4, 5. Mass cash for Sunday, March 24th, 8, 15, 28, 31, and 34. And Lucky for Life rounds out our results for the lottery for Sunday, March 24th, with 5, 19, 30, 37, and 45, with 13, the bonus number. That concludes the lottery results. Good luck to all who play. Remember us if you win. On the cover of today's Cape Cod Times, the headline reads, "A Little Fast, How Authorities Are Using Texts to Help Right Whales," by Heather McCarron. With Massachusetts and Cape Cod bays recognized as important hangout spots for critically endangered North Atlantic right whales, marine life caretakers are always interested in ways to protect them from life-threatening vessel strikes. And now they've got a new tool, neatly wrapped up in existing technology. At the end of January, staff at Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary and Maritime Information Systems, Inc., in cooperation with the U.S. Coast Guard First District out of Boston, successfully transmitted a text message directly to the bridge of a large tanker, informing the navigators they were exceeding the speed limit within the Cape Cod Bay NOAA right whale seasonal management area. the message, which read, maximum speed, 10 knots per, and then there's a long number, a rule, was sent by way of the ship's automatic identification system receiver and charting system display. AIS receivers are navigation safety devices that transmit and monitor the location and characteristics of many vessels in federal and international waters in real time, according to the National Centers for Environmental Information, which is a division of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. In response, the team got a message acknowledging that someone aboard the vessel successfully received the speed limit text. Since then, the system has sent about 40 other speed advisories to vessels crossing the Stellwagen Bank Sanctuary, a 842-square-mile underwater reserve that spans the mouth of Massachusetts Bay from Jeffrey's Ledge, off Cape Ann, to Race Point Channel, off Cape Cod. The new alert system is an encouraging step, Dr. Hanson Johnson, a research scientist in the Anderson Cabot Center for Ocean Life at the New England Aquarium, said, but there is still a lot more work to be done to scale up this effort and identify how to best use this tool to reduce risk most effectively. Marine Information Systems CEO Moses Kaluro said his company, which maintains one of the largest networks of shoreside AIS receivers in the country, has monitored the plight of the right whales for a long time. It's been distressing to watch the downward trend in North Atlantic right whale population, and we've always wanted to help where we could, he said. The push to use AIS to help protect right whales came from an incident in 2021 when an AIS-equipped 54-foot sport fishing boat struck and killed a right whale calf and injured its mother off Florida, he said. It was clear in this instance that the presence of right whales in that area detected by an overflight wasn't relayed to the mariner quickly enough to slow down, Kaluro said. The overflight had happened a few hours earlier that day. The mariner, he said, wouldn't have received word from the U.S. Coast Guard or NOAA in time to slow down when in the area of a recent whale sighting. Stellwagen Bank Superintendent Pete DeCola said Marine Information Systems has done all the programming to make the automated text messaging work. Most vessels 65 feet or longer must travel at 10 knots or less in certain locations called seasonal management areas along the East Coast at certain times of the year. This mandatory regulation is aimed at reducing the chances of collisions with North Atlantic right whales. Vessel strikes, along with entanglements in traditional fishing gear, are the leading causes of death among the whales. Scientists estimate only about 356 individuals, plus or minus maybe seven, are alive today, according to the latest population study that was released this fall. The right whale situation has prompted different innovative strategies within Stellwagen Bank to help protect the animals, DeCola said. In 2007, the sanctuary moved the shipping lanes to divert commercial traffic away from areas where the whales are typically found feeding and socializing. It decreased the likelihood of a ship strike by 80% by moving the shipping lanes just a few miles north, he said. Scattered through the shipping lanes are buoys that can auto-detect right whale calls and transmit the data to the Whale Alert app. And the app uses whale presence data, including verified sightings, acoustic detections from buoys and gliders, and aerial surveys, to display a user-friendly map based on nautical charts from country-specific government agencies, according to the network's website. There are plans to use the new automated messaging method not only to send out speed alerts, but also to transmit near real-time whale sighting data from Whale Alert to vessels with AIS capability. The sanctuary doesn't have the authority to enforce the vessel speed rules. AIS provides the opportunity to do outreach in real time, he said. We're not issuing tickets, we're just the hall monitor, if you will, saying, hey, you're going a little fast. Since the team began the messaging via AIS in January, there have been some great examples of compliance, he said. In most cases, the ships are traveling slightly above the 10 knots allowed. One vessel that was traveling at 12 knots quickly decelerated to below 10 knots after receiving a message, he said. But in general, DeCola said, we find very high compliance with ships that frequently come and go. The ones that are new to Boston Harbor are generally the vessels that have the lower compliance rates. Seeing how effective the messaging can be is gratifying, he said. In tandem with the sanctuary's North Atlantic Right Whale Corporate Responsibility Program, the effort is adding to the state's achievement of the highest compliance rates in the country for seasonal management areas. The Corporate Responsibility Program uses tracking data on commercial vessels to develop ship report cards informing captains and shipping companies about their compliance with the speed rules. It's an important area for right whales, and we're doing all we can, DeCola said. People know we're watching and that we care. Caluro said the goal is to deploy this along the entire East Coast over the next year or so to provide an additional level of protection for the North Atlantic right whale and the mariner. Keeping it local in the Cape and Islands section, spring arrives earlier because of leap year. By Steve Heslip. Spring arrived a day earlier this year on March 19th because of leap year. Mark Twain, never at a loss for a good quip, said, "In the spring, I have counted 136 different kinds of weather inside of 24 hours." To prove him right, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, known as NOAA, reported last week that Earth just had its warmest February on record. By the numbers, the surface temperature was 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average of 53.8 degrees, which is the warmest February in NOAA's 175-year global climate record. NOAA keeps an eye on the world while I get my climate science on a micro level outside on the front steps. On a sunny day, the south-facing bricks warm up, providing a warm perch to daydream on spring afternoons. There are only two steps, just enough room to stretch out for a sweeping view of the neighborhood. The arrival of daylight savings time coincides nicely with the end of the workday, making for some extra long observations. This is strictly I saw it with my own eyes science. Heading into the last week of March, I can report the pansy plant, purchased last spring, has survived winter 2024. Four yellow blooms are pushed up from the mottled leaves, which outlasted several cold spells. The daffodils, long ago planted against the house foundation, are just opening. Out in the front yard, their slower-blooming cousins are still just green shoots. When it comes to gardening, location is everything. The snowdrops are getting ready to call it a season. The young deer wandering through the front lawn at sunrise gave them a long look, but thankfully moved east to the neighbor's yard to graze on their fresh greenery. My contribution to them in early winter was the Rose of Sharon shrub. Oh, mine too, says the reader, which they found particularly tasty until I fortified it with two circles of hardware cloth for protection. It faces an uncertain future heading into spring. The biggest surprise on these first days of spring has been the small violets that pop up out of the not-so-well-tended front lawn. As kids, these were always our choice for a floral bouquet, picked by tiny hands and presented to Mom on Mother's Day. Their shelf life was short in the tiny bone china vase on our dining room table, but the gift was always welcomed. My recollection is the violets arrived later in the spring. But there are no written records in my front porch data bank to check back with, just memories of flowers and the hope that spring brings. Steve Heslip, who wrote this, is the Times' chief photographer. The Brewster Bookstore is under renovation, by Zane Razak. If you've been browsing at Brewster Bookstore, 2648 Main Street lately, you may have smelled paint and heard the sound of saws. The small 41-year-old bookshop, known for matching customers with personalized book recommendations, is undergoing renovations both inside and out while remaining open. Two rooms were taken offline while staff consolidated everything there into the remaining part of the store and shuffled other sections around. Everyone has been so patient and so understanding as they continue to support us. We've been so grateful for that, said Jessica Devon, who owns the store with longtime friend Sue O'Malley. Devon and O'Malley first took ownership in October of 2021 when the two partnered to buy the store from David Landon, son of store founder Nancy Landon. The store started in just the front room of the main section of the building, with Devon's mother and aunt being among the first store employees. One of their first moves after buying the store was transforming the upstairs. They created the book nook, a newly renovated one-bedroom apartment with well-stocked bookshelves and cozy reading room, according to the website. The space is available through Airbnb and is often used by visiting authors. Meanwhile, the bookstore's secret garden, which is a small enclosed spot, is being revamped. The space is currently used for author talks, story time, and other events. The owners envision expanding it to make it more interactive, with a DIY hotel for pollinators, a composting wall, and more. They plan to create new features by reusing found items. As an example, one wall will be created with logs that were rescued from trees that had to be cut down. The overhaul, planned for indoors, is aimed at making the business more accessible. Currently, customers have to traverse two steps at the entrance. The store also has three different levels inside. Interior ramps and a new fully accessible entry door will be added to make the store easier for people with wheelchairs, walkers, and strollers to navigate. Because of all the renovations, the store can host more events year-round, as its lack of indoor space limits it from holding activities in the winter. Devin said staff ideas range from flower arranging classes to writers' workshops. As someone who grew up on the Cape, I fully value the importance of having a really rich, vibrant wintertime community, said Devin. We really so strongly believe in community and being passionate about providing the community experience throughout the year and not just the summertime. That's all the local news in today's Monday, March 25th, Cape Cod time. So we'll move on to the regional and national news. Eclipse will be so dark, solar power will plummet, reads the headline on the front page. This is written by Phaedra Trethen and Elizabeth Wise. The path of April's total solar eclipse will be so dark that Texas electric grid managers are forecasting a sudden, brief drop in solar power as the eclipse crosses the state. But experts say there's no need to worry. The Electric Reliability Council of Texas, known as ERCOT, E-R-C-O-T, has predicted that the eclipse will reduce solar generation's maximum output to less than 10% of what it would be capable of if the sky was clear, but that other sources of energy can compensate for the dip. It's a sign of how powerful the darkness will be as the awesome event unfolds, but it isn't particularly concerning to energy experts. Every energy technology we use comes with trade-offs, said Melissa Lott of Columbia University's Climate School, and that includes solar power. Substantial problems during the April 8th solar eclipse will not be part of that trade-off, added Lott, a professor and senior director of research at Columbia's School of International and Public Affairs Center on Global Energy Policy. Here's why. Lott, who said she's been fielding calls from concerned friends and relatives who rely on solar power, is happy to reassure energy consumers that even those in the eclipse's path of totality, an arc from Texas to Maine across the U.S., won't notice much of a difference as other power sources like natural gas or hydropower are tapped by utility companies to make up for the temporary loss of solar power. We know the path it's going to take. We have really good information to predict how long it's going to last, said Lott. The people who run power grids can compensate because they know what to expect. Unlike a natural disaster or a sudden weather emergency, utility companies can prepare for an eclipse with a path, timing, and duration that are certain, Lott said. A 2017 study by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory traced the impact of a total solar eclipse on August 21st of that year, looking at grid operations across 14 western states, British Columbia, and northern Baja California. The 2017 total solar eclipse came and went without causing any issues to the operation of the North American electric power system, the study concluded. What was predicted ahead of the 2017 eclipse versus what happened was pretty much dead on, said Lott. Will the eclipse cause problems for people with solar panels? Well, there's a specific and highly unlikely scenario where homeowners could see their power briefly impacted. They would have to be disconnected from a traditional power grid and fully reliant on solar power and be in the path of totality. Given that, Lott said the eclipse isn't cause for concern. So, enjoy the eclipse. Listen for the sounds of the birds and insects. Feel the change in outdoor temperatures. Gaze in wonder, safely with proper eyewear, at the celestial show. The next headline from the Cape Cod Times of March 25th tells us that some cancers are afflicting younger adults, by Karen Weintraub and Kayla Jimenez. Princess Kate's cancer diagnosis at age 42 shines a light on a dreaded disease that seems to be striking people at younger ages, though it has become more survivable. Americans have about a 40% chance of developing cancer at some point in their lives, and just under 20% who develop it die from cancer, which is the second leading cause of death in the U.S. It's typically considered a disease of aging, with 88% of diagnoses coming in people age 50 and older, according to the American Cancer Society. But colon cancer is increasing in younger people, according to the National Cancer Institute. Americans born between 1981 and 1996 are at twice the risk for colon cancer as those born in 1950. Other cancers have also increased in younger adults, though it's not clear why. After a diagnosis, people often try to look back to understand how and why they could have gotten sick and what they might have done wrong, said Ginger Gardner, Dr. Ginger Gardner, a gynecologic surgeon at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Often they did nothing at all. Cancer doesn't always play by the rules, she told USA Today. The good news is that many types of cancer are now survivable for years, if not decades, and the quality of life for survivors has improved markedly, and there are ways to improve the odds. Boosting odds of beating cancer. Whenever cancer happens, and certainly in a young population, it really does underscore the importance of several key teachable moments, or moments of awareness, Gardner said. The first, she said, is to be aware of your body. If something feels different, be proactive and get it checked out, she said. That might mean a change in bowel movements, pelvic pressure, or discomfort, bloating, or rectal bleeding, said Dr. Richard Barakat, physician-in-chief and executive director of the Northwell Health Cancer Institute, which operates 21 hospitals and 10 cancer centers in New York. Screening also offers an opportunity to catch certain cancers early when the odds of survival are better and the treatments typically less harsh. Federal guidelines suggest people start routine screening for cervical cancer at age 21, colon cancer at 45, breast cancer no later than 45 with an option to start at 40, lung cancer at 50 for smokers, and prostate cancer at 55 for people at average risk for the disease, while those at higher risk should start earlier. The HPV vaccine can dramatically reduce the risk of several cancers, including cancer of the cervix, penis, and anus. Genetics and family history can also be useful, as more treatments and screens are now tied to specific patterns of genetics, Gardner said. Some genes, such as BRCA1 and BRCA2, that's BRCA1 and BRCA2, are associated with specific cancers like breast and ovarian, leading some people to get preventive surgeries, while some genetic conditions, including one called Lynch syndrome, can increase the risk for a wide range of cancers. Gardner is particularly passionate about gynecologic cancers. Someone's diagnosed every 5 minutes in the U.S., and research into them is woefully underfunded, she said. There are five cancer types considered gynecologic: cervical, ovarian, uterine, vaginal, and vulvar. We are in a very exciting time of research and understanding the biology of these diseases better, Gardner said. Women's cancers need more attention. Cancer strikes about 1.6 million Americans a year, killing more than 600,000. The American Cancer Society projects 611,720 people will die from some form of cancer in 2024. That number is slightly higher than a year ago, but much lower than in 1991. The rate of people who die from cancer dropped 33% from 1991 through 2021, according to the organization's most recent statistics. The latest data from the CDC shows 1,603,844 new cancer cases were reported, and 602,347 people died of cancer in the U.S. in 2020. Just over 400 new cancers were reported, and 144 cancer-related deaths for every 100,000 people, according to the latest data available from the CDC. What cancers are most common? The most common types of cancer include breast, lung, prostate, colon, rectal, and a type of skin cancer called melanoma, according to the National Cancer Institute. Men are most likely to have prostate, lung, and colorectal cancers. Women are most likely to have breast, lung, and colorectal cancers. Lifestyle activities help reduce cancer risk, including limiting tobacco and alcohol, eating a healthy diet without too many heavily processed foods, and avoiding too much sun exposure, according to the CDC. It's not clear why some cancers are increasing among younger people, Barakat said. Factors that have been considered include the environment, changes in the gut microbiome, and obesity. It's quite worrisome, he said. Contributing to that story was Ken Altucker of USA Today. Final headline on the front page of the Cape Cod Times, dated March 25th, a Monday, reads, "Video shows first Neuralink patient playing online chess." Amazing story here by Sarah Al-Arshani. The first patient to get a cybernetic implant from Elon Musk's Neuralink company appeared to move a cursor using his brain to play online chess in a video released by the company. In a live-streamed video on X, formerly Twitter, on Wednesday, Nolan Arbaugh moves the cursor on a computer without using any physical tools. Arbaugh, who's 29 years old, said he used his mind to play the online chess game. It was like using the force, Arbaugh said. Arbaugh's been paralyzed from the shoulders down after a freak diving accident 8 years ago, he said in the video. He loved playing chess, he said, but it hasn't been something he was able to do often in the past few years. Now it's all being done with my brain. You can see the cursor moving around the screen. That's all me, he explained. Arbaugh, an Arizona native, was a student and athlete at Texas A&M when he became paralyzed, according to a GoFundMe that was set up in 2017 to help him get a handicapped access van. According to the fundraiser, Arbaugh was working as a summer camp counselor for children when he got into the accident that left him quadriplegic in 2016. "I'm paralyzed from below the shoulders. I have no sensation or movement below my level of injury, so below my shoulders," Arbaugh said in the live stream. An avid gamer, Arbaugh said, Neuralink gave him the ability to play games again, including Civilization VI, which he played for 8 hours straight. "I had basically given up on playing that game," he said. "I just wasn't really able to play it as much as I wanted to, and you all gave me that ability again. It's already changed my life." Arbaugh is the first person to use this new technology. In January, Musk announced the first human to receive the brain chip was recovering well. "Initial results show promising neuron spike detection," Musk said in a post on X after the procedure. During the live stream Wednesday, Arbaugh said he had no issues following his surgery. "Surgery was super easy. I literally was released from the hospital a day later, and I have no cognitive impairments." However, Arbaugh said the technology is not perfect and they have run into some issues. "I don't want people to think this is the end of a journey because there are things to work out, but it's already changed my life," he said. The goal of Neuralink's brain-computer interface, or BCI, is to allow paralyzed people to create and control a computer or mobile device wirelessly just by thinking about it, according to the company's website. "Imagine if Stephen Hawking could communicate faster than a speed typist or auctioneer. That's the goal," Musk said in a post on X, or Twitter. In May, the tech startup owned and co-founded by Musk announced it received approval from the FDA to implant brain chips into humans. The company announced in September that it received approval to recruit someone for the first in-human clinical trial of the new technology. Musk said the product is called telepathy. Amazing science. We are just at the midway point in our reading, and regular listeners are well aware, I'm sure, that it's at this stage in the reading that we move to a different kind of local news, the obituaries and death notices that are posted in the Cape Cod Times or the newspaper we're reading that day. The first obituary in today's Cape Cod Times, dated Monday, March 25th of 2024, is of Megan Moore of Centerville, who at the age of 25 tragically passed away on March 16th, leaving us all far too soon. Beloved daughter of Billy and Mary Beth and sister to Will and Molly, Megan's humor and zest for life will be profoundly missed, but forever remembered. A standout athlete at Barnstable High School, Megan carried her passion to New England College as a proud member of the women's ice hockey team, graduating in 2021. She was also a favorite among both staff and patrons every summer at Spanky's Clam Shack, the beloved harborside restaurant run by the Moore family. Her smile lit up the Hyannis Harbor, and she had recently embraced a new adventure working in the Miami restaurant world. In celebration of Megan Moore's life, a foundation has been established by Megan's family and friends to continue her legacy. Megan was a shining example of determination and loyalty, and we aim to honor her memory by empowering future student athletes. The Megan Moore Foundation will annually award a scholarship to a female outstanding student athlete, enabling them to pursue their academic and athletic aspirations. The Moore family extends their deepest gratitude for the outpouring of support during this unimaginably difficult time. Megan is survived by her parents, her siblings, and many who will miss her dearly. A visitation will be held at Our Lady of Victory, 230 South Main Street, in Centerville, Mass., on Tuesday, March 26th. That's tomorrow, from 4 to 8 p.m., to celebrate and honor Megan's life. A funeral Mass will be held on Wednesday, March 27th, at 11 a.m., also at Our Lady of Victory. The burial will follow at St. Francis Xavier Cemetery in Centerville. Please join the family following the services at the Hyannis Yacht Club, 490 Ocean Street in Hyannis. The next obituary in today's Cape Cod Times of March 25th is of Marjorie Marshall of Falmouth, a loving wife, mother, sister, grandmother, great-grandmother, and friend, who passed peacefully on March 19th. She was born May 3rd, 1927, in Medford. She was excellent in many sports in high school, and that passion continued into her education, where she earned her bachelor's degree in physical ed at Bridgewater State College. Following graduation, Marge embarked on a teaching career in Great Neck, New York. Love called her back to Massachusetts, however, when she met Donald Lyle Marshall of Medford, and they married in 1952. Together, they built a beautiful life, starting with a family soon after their wedding, with four children. Marge and Don raised their children in Sudbury, where they were active members of the community and developed lifelong friendships. Marge was the heart and soul of many gatherings, most often being the organizer. Whether it was delivering cold drinks by the tennis court, hosting poolside appetizers, or orchestrating unforgettable holiday celebrations for her family, she always possessed the gift of bringing people together and creating lasting memories. In addition to her sister Elizabeth MacArthur of Hyannis, she's survived by her children and their partners and many who will miss her dearly. She was predeceased by her beloved husband, Donald Lyle Marshall, who passed in 2000. Any donations in her memory can be sent to the North Falmouth Congregational Church in North Falmouth, Massachusetts. The burial will be private, with a memorial service to be announced at a later date. The final obituary in today's Cape Cod Times of March 25th is of Dorothy Morrissey of Sandwich, who at the age of 86 passed on March 18th. Known as Dot, she was born in West Lafayette, Indiana on Valentine's Day, 1938. After graduating from Amherst High School, Dot attended the University of Massachusetts in Amherst before changing paths and graduating from the registered nursing program at the Franklin County Public Hospital School of Nursing in 1960. It was during this time she met Thomas, her husband of 62 years, who was attending the UMass biology program along with her brother Robert. She and Tom married in 1960 and made their home on Cape Cod, where she specialized in emergency room nursing and retired after a distinguished career at Toby Hospital in Wareham. She is survived by many who will miss her dearly. She was preceded in death by her husband Thomas, as well as her parents and brothers. Public calling hours will be held on Thursday, March 28th, this Thursday, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Nickerson Bourne Funeral Home, located at 154 Route 6A in Sandwich. Interment with her husband will follow at 2 p.m. at the Massachusetts National Cemetery in Bourne. And that concludes the obituaries that are listed in today's Cape Cod Times, dated Monday, March 25th of 2024. Moving back into the news section in the front of the paper, good news in this headline for a change. Number of homeless veterans in Massachusetts has plummeted by Maya Shevitt, BU Statehouse Program. When Joe Tocci, or Tocci, T-O-C-C-I, was discharged from the U.S. Marines in 2008, he had an identity crisis. When I was homeless, I remember always thinking to myself, they see me as this homeless guy, but they have no idea the things I accomplished in the military, the responsibilities I had, the millions of dollars of gear I was responsible for, and the people's lives I was responsible for, said Tocci. Now as a supervising peer specialist for the State Department of Veteran Affairs, he sees much more robust resources for veterans experiencing homelessness. It's totally advanced, said Tocci. We're here with you. We're here to support you. We're not above you. We're not below you. We are just going to navigate this together. Governor Maura Healey announced an effort to curb the homelessness of veterans in Massachusetts with a new $20 million budget proposal, while House Democrats voted to put time limits for people seeking refuge in the state's shelters. These announcements come months after the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development found that homelessness nationally was at an all-time high, but the number of total veterans experiencing homelessness was the second to lowest ever. Massachusetts homeless veteran census has followed a similar pattern overall. While homelessness nationally continues to be devastating, there's a glimmer of light for Massachusetts veterans, according to experts. The veteran's story just sort of demonstrates what's possible. When we dedicate the right type of resources at the scale needed to address homelessness, said Boston University professor Thomas Byrne, an expert on social welfare and homelessness. Big picture, veterans have a more positive trajectory in terms of landing housing than other groups facing homelessness in Massachusetts due to the services that are created both federally and adopted locally. The VA is committed to addressing homelessness among veterans, and they've invested a lot of resources and programs specifically targeted to veterans. There's more resources available for homeless veterans than there are for non-veterans, said Byrne. While the overall number of veterans has gone down, the number of veterans has plateaued in the most recent reports in Massachusetts. The Healey-Driscoll administration has said it hopes with this push they can get close to achieving functional zero, a federal term meaning a system where veteran homelessness is a rare, brief, and non-recurring thing. New Bedford, Lowell, and Lynn have already achieved this milestone. Boston's rate of homelessness has decreased by about 50% in the last decade, according to Mayor Michelle Wu. Veterans have some unique needs when it comes to housing due to their in-service and post-service experiences. They have increased risks of suicide, and they struggle finding support while navigating their traumas, according to Veterans Affairs Boston Health Director Chris Dollard. There are many, many individuals who are disenfranchised in our society, and those are the same ones I see struggling to access some of the services that we have, said Dollard, naming untreated mental health problems and substance abuse as two main factors. Generally, veterans who are homeless have worse medical conditions across the board. They have higher rates of both acute and chronic diseases compared to other individuals. There's also a higher mortality rate, said Martha Duffy. Dr. Martha Duffy, staff physician and a primary care provider on the Homeless Patient Aligned Care Team of the VA. Veterans experience trimorbidity, meaning they have multiple overlapping factors that relate to poor health, according to Duffy. You're 63 or whatever, but really, because of the lifestyle that you've had in the past, you're really 73 or 70 or 80. Physically, that's a big part of homeless vets today. If they're on the street, they get aged pretty quickly. It's pretty rough being out there on the cold ground, said James Reed, the executive director of the Veterans Transition House in New Bedford. The VA most commonly resettles homeless or near homeless veterans through its flagship HUD Veterans Affairs Supportive Housing Program. Currently, there are 1,313 Boston vouchers actively matching veterans with housing services. VA Boston also has a unique program called the CATCH, C-A-T-C-H in capitals, program to identify and help veterans who have gone to the emergency room. The biggest barrier is for those that have been charged with sex offenses because they're not eligible for many HUD programs, according to Dollard. Other barriers for veterans include unit availability, the general lack of affordable housing in Boston, and payment standard rates in apartments changing mid-application, according to Liam Connolly, an outreach social worker for veterans. And many, I believe, are charged with sex offenses because of public urination or using the streets as a toilet. And those are, I believe, sexual offenses. And that could be why they are not eligible for many programs. Most veterans experiencing homelessness are males, like about 90%, and women veterans make up about 10%. I'll say that most of the research is very binary with men and women. It doesn't take into account a lot of gender identity issues, even though we know that trans individuals have a higher rate of housing instability than non-trans individuals. But the research still doesn't really look at these overlapping issues, said Duffy. Military sexual trauma puts people at a higher risk of PTSD, mental health problems, substance use problems, and homelessness. I think the risk for women veterans is 3 to 4 times higher to become homeless than non-veterans, said Duffy. The VA requires that a veteran hit certain requirements to be eligible for its programs that include rehousing. The state has its own voucher program as one solution, but as another, organizations like the Veterans Transition House in New Bedford focus on filling in the gaps for vulnerable veterans with housing programs and recovery support because they receive funding from federal, state, and local sources. We had an individual here that was known in the city in New Bedford for being homeless, and then we found out that he was a vet, said Reed. He needed a medical procedure that he didn't realize he could get done, and he got that done, and now he's so happy. He came in, he stayed with us, and I drove into the driveway one day, and there he is doing yoga. He was reinvented, reinvigorated. What are wraparound services? Tochi went to the Veterans Transition House around 2010, where he used their wraparound services that functioned to care for homeless veterans' mental, physical, and emotional challenges. Wraparound services have changed the way that most vulnerable people are cared for, and they're one of the main factors contributing to the success seen by InLarge when looking at the decrease in homelessness for veterans in Massachusetts. With the wraparound services, we can bring them in, talk to them, see what's going on, and then try to mitigate any kind of feelings of them being at risk or anything like that, said Reed. There are several challenges to getting rehoused for Massachusetts's entire homeless population. You know, it depends on credit, eviction records, whether or not we're going to get at least a neutral landlord reference, or if there's money owed to a housing authority, said Doris Romero, housing stability advocate at the Women's Lunch Place, emphasizing that actual affordable housing is the most critical need. For the non-veteran community, the lack of space is felt deeply. There's just no space anywhere within the greater Boston area, and it's something that I haven't seen in the time that I've been doing the work, said Romero. Let alone, you know, parents with children who are on a wait list. Once an individual has an address, they can get their own mail. That's an important step toward independence and accessibility, according to Henry Morris, communications manager of Women's Lunch Place, who noted that the guests at his facility need to use their address on Newbury Street when they don't have other options. Once a homeless individual's in housing, stabilization is a critical step that can be terrifying. It's very, very frightening and isolating when you first move into housing, said Romero. I just think of our ladies that move into housing, but they're not even comfortable sleeping in their own bed. They feel most comfortable sleeping on the floor in a sleeping bag. Community is necessary for all people experiencing homelessness, but especially for the homeless veterans who were steeped in camaraderie from their time in branches of the military. Well, I know for me, community's very big. When I was in the military, those Marines and Navy corpsmen were my family. I mean, we went through the darkest, darkest times, and then the happiest times, and we got through it together, said Tochi, who noted that his military family was regarded as the untouchables because of their intense bond. Veterans continue to be a vulnerable population, but the stream of targeted resources from the federal government has made an impact. Other homeless populations are struggling without such paths. Whatever money that they do throw at it, unless there's like a long-term subsidy, it can be used in a matter of like 2 or 3 months, said Romero on the House proposal to emergency family shelter limits. A little political news. Christie won't rule out third-party presidential run by Carissa Waddick. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is no longer ruling out a third-party presidential bid with the centrist group No Labels. Christie said he would do whatever he could to make sure the country doesn't go through the misery of a second Trump term during an appearance on the podcast The Axe Files, hosted by former President Barack Obama advisor David Axelrod. I wouldn't preclude anything at this point, David, he said in response to a direct question about whether he was considering a run. I would just say that there are a number of hurdles to get over before I would actually consider running as a third party. No Labels, which is a bipartisan nonprofit organization, is searching for candidates to appear on a potential unity ticket in the November election. A number of high-profile officials have been tied to the group, including former Maryland GOP Governor Larry Hogan and Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia. But many have ruled out running on the group's presidential push. One of the main concerns is that the group could act as a spoiler in the November general election and split the vote between President Joe Biden, who's 81 years old, and former President Donald Trump, who's 77 years old, both the presumptive nominees. The centrist think tank Third Way has criticized No Labels, arguing that its third-party run could hand the 2024 election to Trump. But Christie, who's one of Trump's most vocal Republican critics, pushed back against those concerns. I don't think you can game that out 7 months before an election, he told Axelrod. Christie argued that Biden's age and Trump's sweeping legal charges already made the 2024 election unprecedented. Do I think it's likely a third-party candidate could be elected president? No, I don't think it's likely, he said. Do I think it's possible? In this environment, anything is possible. Christie, who's a former prosecutor, decided to suspend his campaign for the Republican nomination in early January after finding he didn't have a feasible path to the nomination. His openness to the possibility of a third-party run is a sharp departure from previous comments he's made about the option. Shortly before he dropped out of the GOP primary, Christie outright rejected a No Labels run. The next headline, tribes seek funds to help deal with crime. Reservations in the U.S. lack resources to secure land, by Molly Young on the of the Oklahoman in Oklahoma City. Tribal nations need more money from Congress to keep people safe, their leaders told federal lawmakers. officials representing tribes in Oklahoma and 14 other states said on March 20th that inadequate funding has hamstrung their criminal justice systems, leaving them unable to fully address the opioid crisis. Many leaders also called on Congress to restore the power of tribal courts over all people suspected of dealing drugs and committing other crimes on reservations, not just those who are Native. There's a commonality with all of the problems, and the commonality is that tribal nations have been handcuffed in their ability to protect their own, said Jonodev Chaduri, an ambassador and citizen of the Muscogee Nation in eastern Oklahoma. Chaduri and the other tribal officials spoke at a listening session held by the Senate Indian Affairs Committee. Senator Brian Schatz, a Hawaii Democrat who chairs the committee, said hearing about the most pressing public safety issues facing tribal nations would help lawmakers prioritize their next steps. Senator John Tester, a Democrat from Montana, acknowledged that no single fix would solve the crises many tribal communities face. Tribal and federal law enforcement agencies need more resources across the board to begin solving the problem, said Tester. The discussion on Capitol Hill landed as several tribal nations in Oklahoma worked to expand their criminal justice systems across their reservations after regaining legal recognition in the past 4 years. Charles Addington, who leads the Quapaw Nation Marshals Service in the northeast part of the state, said federal funding often stays at the federal level, within agencies like the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which has its own law enforcement arm, rather than reaching tribal nations directly. In order to make a difference, you've got to make sure you're being partners with these tribal law enforcement programs, said Addington, a Cherokee Nation citizen. The current system creates a checkerboard approach to addressing crime and enforcing the law, Chaduri said. The solution is empowering local governments on the ground, he said. Has always been the solution. He joined more than a dozen other tribal members in asking for Congress to pass a law that would expand the power of tribal courts over non-Native defendants. The Supreme Court ruled in 1978 that tribal courts do not have inherent criminal jurisdiction over people who aren't Native American, and that only Congress can assign that jurisdiction. Lawmakers have done so as recently as 2022 when they extended the jurisdiction of tribal courts to cover anyone accused of sexually abusing, trafficking, or stalking a Native person, as well as some other related crimes. Congress should extend that list to cover all crimes on tribal land, said Mark Macaro, who's chairman of the tribal chairman of the Pachanga Band of Luiseno Indians in California and president of the National Congress of American Indians. Indian country is in acute crisis right now and has been for decades, actually. Crisis in law enforcement, crisis in public safety, crisis in justice, he said. One of the fundamental solutions is the restoration of our own sovereign governments to protect our citizens in their own homes and on our lands. Our next headline from the Cape Cod Times, dated Monday, March 25th of 2024. UMC set for historic meeting in North Carolina. Some seek change after the church's mass exodus, by Liam Adams from the Nashville Tennessean. A gathering of the United Methodist Church's top legislative body next month will be historic for the nation's largest mainline Protestant denomination, but not in the way many originally anticipated. The UMC General Conference, which meets every 4 years, is set to convene April 23rd in Charlotte, North Carolina, to decide which legislation will shape the long-term future of the denomination. The General Conference, originally scheduled for 2020, postponed due to the COVID-19 pandemic, follows a 5-year-long exodus of mainly conservative churches. Between 2019 and 2023, the United Methodist Church lost about a quarter of its total churches. With all of the changes that have happened in our midst, we find ourselves in a seminal moment in the life of this denomination, said Bishop Thomas Bickerton, president of the UMC Council of Bishops in a March 1st delegate orientation speech. It's a marker point. It's a shift, a pivot from what was to what can be. More than 7,000 churches left the denomination or disaffiliated in the past 5 years following disputes over theology and church policy, including dealing with LGBTQ+ rights. Many disaffiliated churches joined a more conservative breakaway denomination, the Global Methodist Church. During the two-week event, 862 General Conference delegates representing a dozen-plus countries will vote on removing anti-LGBTQ+ policies, potential major changes in the denomination's international structure, and a drastically reduced budget. Delegates, UMC agencies, and others have submitted 1,000-plus petitions ahead of time. During the first week of the General Conference, 15 different legislative committees will sort through those petitions and decide which ones to approve and/or consolidate to send to the full General Conference. The 862 delegates will then spend the second week debating and voting on those proposals. The second week of business is accessible to the public via live stream. Amid dozens of important decisions facing the UMC General Conference, three rise to the top. LGBTQ+ rights. LGBTQ+ rights has consistently been the most contentious issue at the UMC General Conference in prior years, so much so that it set the stage for the splintering in the denomination. Quote, no discussion of social witness legislation would be complete without mentioning LGBTQ inclusion, said United Methodist News reporter Sam Hodges in a February 29th delegate orientation presentation. This time could be different due to the recent conservative exodus, potentially yielding success for progressive proposals to remove bans on ordination of LGBTQ+ people, prohibitions on UMC clergy or churches blessing same-sex unions, and financial penalties for United Methodist churches and other groups that promote the acceptance of homosexuality. Also, the same group is seeking changes to the UMC revised social principles, which currently says, quote, homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching, end quote. Regionalization. Referring to a series of legislative proposals, regionalization would fundamentally alter the relationship between the UMC, the United Methodist Church in the U.S., and in other countries. Guided by the principle of decolonization, regionalization would give United Methodist regional authorities in other countries more autonomy. Progressives support regionalization because it would allow the American church to move in a more LGBTQ+ affirming direction, for example, while United Methodists in conservative regions can maintain stricter policies. But opponents of the proposal, most of whom are conservative and now part of the Global Methodist Church, want the UMC General Conference to expand and extend a policy allowing disaffiliation, which expired at the end of 2023. The regionalization proposal includes constitutional amendments, thus requiring ratification by not only the General Conference, but regional legislative bodies, explained United Methodist News reporter Heather Hahn in a March 1st delegation orientation presentation. As a result, if passed, the regionalization proposal won't take effect, likely until 2026, Hahn said. And number three, finances. Approving a budget will be one of the last decisions by the UMC General Conference and the beginning of drastic changes in the months to come. The Nashville-based UMC General Council on Finance and Admin, which is the denomination's administrative agency, is recommending a 43% decrease to the overall budget. Since the last time the UMC General Conference approved a budget in 2016's regular session, disaffiliation and church closures torpedoed revenue projections now require major cuts at every level of the UMC. A more immediate effect following the General Conference will be when jurisdictional conferences meet later this year to decide on bishops' rosters. Most jurisdictional conferences will likely halt new bishop appointments and expand existing bishops' responsibilities. The UMC has grown accustomed in recent decades to emotionally charged debates during official business proceedings and in other moments such as disruptive protests. But UMC leaders hope for different energy this year. The recent delegate orientation featured a panel on dialogue and disagreement. United Methodist News recently reported that prominent traditionalist advocacy groups still plan to attend the Charlotte conference and lobby. Those groups have previously coalesced voting power with centrists to pass or preserve anti-LGBTQ plus policies. And with that, we've come to the end of our reading of today's e-edition of the Cape Cod Times, dated Monday, March 25th of 2024. This is your reader, Eric, saying be well, be safe, look after each other, remember our veterans. Bye for now.